I'm an addict. My name's Harry. It's really good to be at a Narcotics Anonymous function, and I'm grateful to be here. This is where I need to be. There was one person here. If you're a newcomer, I'd like to extend a real welcome to you. You're in a good place and a safe place to be. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself so you can put my comments in perspective. I was admitted to the State Bar of California in 1978. I've been practicing going on 38 years, and I had experience with the criminal justice system before that. I've done mostly criminal law, and I've handled cases, hundreds of them involving drugs, possession of drugs, possession for sale, burglaries, several homicide cases to trial, some of which were high publicity. And I personally experienced during the course of my practice what it was like to spin out of control and have to ask for help. I know what it's like to have a judge look at you and be concerned about it. I ended up going into the State Bar Attorneys Program for several years. I participated in drug testing protocols and requirements that in order to keep my license and be good standing, that I would do meetings, that I would attend therapy sessions, and that I would routinely drug test. I did that for 5 years, and then I volunteered for another 3 years. And in the end, I was grateful to do that because I ended up trying a multi-defendant murder for hire case with a lot of publicity, and at the end of it, I had to get out, and the attorney who came in to take the place of it wanted to confront me on the record about drug use. And I have to tell you that at that point in my life, I was never more grateful than to know I could be able to say that I had clean time in Narcotics Anonymous, that I had participated in programs, and that I had tested clean for, at that point, 8 years. When I was asked to look at the topic of the interrelationship between Narcotics Anonymous and the courts, I was a little befuddled because for all these years I have referred people to Narcotics Anonymous, been in the program, but I never looked at it from the perspective of explaining it to someone in terms of how NA relates to the courts and how the courts view Narcotics Anonymous. And the truth is that, and I'm going to share a little secret with you here, you can do a lot of the research I did, and I did a lot online, but most of you may have the experience of lawyers standing up in court and citing different cases to the judge, or you'll see them on TV. And you now can have access to those cases, every one of you here, without having to go to the law library or to pay for it. It's a little secret called Google Scholar. And if you go to Google and you put in Scholar, it's going to come up with a search window that gives you a chance to look at case law. And California case law and the federal ones. And I did that this week. I did it because I wanted to be able to further understand how Narcotics Anonymous relates to the courts, other than just from a perspective of having a client under the influence and trying to explain to a judge what he or she should or should not do. And I found it fascinating. And the one thing that I learned is that when you put in the two search words, Narcotics and Anonymous, most of what you come up with are anonymous informants and narcotics cases. So you have to make it, quotation marks, Narcotics Anonymous. And then I was thinking about, why are we here? I mean, truly, if you think about many of the ideas that lead us to be in Narcotics Anonymous or even to have society participate in trying to regulate our behavior, because for many people, they're putting something in their body to change how they feel. And in an abstract sense, whose business is that other than the person who wants to do that? So I started looking back at the history, and I'd heard early on that drugs have been a part of society forever, that they've been a part of the early nature of man. And I thought, well, okay, for that, so why today? What's important to us today? And I'd like to share some things with you. And if you'll pardon me, I want to read them. So this is a good time, I think. I'm saying this as a lawyer and as a recovering addict, because there's a light that's being shown today on addiction that never has been, in the sense of mainstream society learning about who we are, learning about what addiction is about, and caring. Really caring. And some people that I haven't heard from in the past, like Carly Fiorina. Carly Fiorina is running on the Republican platform to be the president. She offered the following: my husband Frank and I buried a child to drug addiction. Many people may have forgotten that Jeb Bush's daughter was arrested on drug-related charges in 2002, and she has spent time in rehab facilities. He has talked about this at some of his campaign stops. And Chris Christie, who is another Republican candidate, has gone viral. If you haven't seen it on the internet, it's worth a look at. He's talking tearfully about how drug addiction to painkillers cost him, or cost a friend of his life. So right now, there's a lot of attention focused on the topic in a compassionate sense. And it hasn't always been that way. There hasn't been the slightest spotlight that's been directed towards the concept of addiction or addicts. Now, if you look at right now today, and you look at 2015, and you compare it to 2013, 2010, and 2002, the statistics that judges and police and legislators are seeing are scaring them, and they should. When you look at the causes of death, and there was a recent report that came out this week, we've jumped to 46,471 drug overdose deaths. That is more than guns. It's more than car accidents. It's more than most of the other causes of death. The DEA talked about drugs. I'm not sure that the DEA realizes what Narcotics Anonymous realizes, and that is alcohol is a drug. There were 36,000 deaths from cirrhosis of the liver, 29,000 direct alcohol deaths. Now, in 2000, all illicit drugs combined cost 17,000 deaths. We've gone from 17,000 up to 50,000, basically. So the change in the last 3 years has been substantial. And that, I think, is part of why the topic is getting such attention and why people need to be afraid. And one of the things that I want to share with you right now is that people don't know what to do with addiction. People don't know what to do with addicts. And to them, addiction and addicts are a huge problem. Many people today, many parents are finding children addicted, and they have no idea what to do with it. All of a sudden, their children haven't been around those people, or they haven't been exposed to circumstances where their parents would think they'd have to worry. And all of a sudden, it's across the board. And they're learning what many of us have known for a long time now, and that is, it doesn't matter who you are, and it doesn't matter what your background is, and it doesn't matter what your employment or your race or your color or your religion. That once you get into addiction, We are all in this room exactly the same. We are all addicts. And I then thought back to that question of, well, why does it matter? And how long has the problem been around? And are we just learning about this? And I would commend to you to go out and do some research, because just go out, plug in Google and look at ancient drug use, and you're gonna find astonishing things out there. You go look and you're gonna find that in the Egyptian mummies, they were finding cocaine, they were finding marijuana. And they're using the same things to determine that from history that they're using today to find it in people's bodies. China was having its first experience with opium in the 700s when the Arabians were bringing it over. And that transaction, that trade, exploded in China over the years up to about 45,000 long tons per year of opium. If you try to imagine what 45,000 tons is like, I can't wrap my head around it. Now, we had our Tea Party here in the United States. We all know that. How many of you know that China had an opium party? They burned 1,000 tons of it. They were fed up with it, and it was the involvement of the British and the East Indian Company making money off of that the Chinese got upset with, and that led to an actual war. It's called the Opium Wars. So the history of how we're getting to today is long, and part of what I think is just an interesting side note is that many governments financed how they ran their society by taxing drugs. And today, after this evil marijuana drug that causes reefer madness and will take everybody down that awful road, now what are we doing? One of the guys who founded Facebook and Netgear is pushing a program today to try to get on the ballot the decriminalization in California, both for medical and recreation of marijuana, with a 15% tax. I don't want to get into a lot of political discussion, but I find it really interesting that as time changes and we go back, I'm not going to talk more about it, as it won't be polite. So when we look at drugs and drug history, we can also look back to their finding. If any of you've seen the Egyptian hieroglyphs in the tombs, well, if you look at those, look at the pipes, go online and check, and there's some reason to believe that the reason that they were having some of these weird, bizarre dreams and all of that was because they were using this long pipe out to there. So it's been around for a long time, and there's proof today, and there's actual physical proof in bodies of the existence of drugs and drug use. Well, okay, so why today? We'll have a little roundtable afterwards, and Jeff is gonna ask him to share just a little bit about how marijuana came to be made illegal in the States and why we are where we are. But the bottom line for all of us is that society is concerned about it. Society looks at addicts and addiction as a problem, and for many of us, we end up in the courts. And I'd like to talk about that just a little bit. I want you to know something. For going on 40 years, I leave court with clients and I ask them, do you know what just happened? And they say, oh yeah. And then I ask them to repeat back to me what happened, and they really don't get it. They don't understand things like, how did it resolve? Why did the judge make the decision that the judge made? Why are they referred to probation? Why are they referred to treatment programs or 12-step programs? And it's hard to understand that sometimes, but I think by the end of our discussion, we'll understand that not only are we addicts and addiction viewed as the problem, but I'm learning that we addicts are part of the solution. We addicts are part of the solution in terms of the education process and the participation. So what goes on in a judge's mind? What goes on in a DA's mind? What's going on at that courthouse when one of us comes to their attention? Let me tell you that it depends on who the judge is, who the DA is, which department are you in, which county are you in, which state are you in. And many times I have seen prosecutors who are unbelievably compassionate, prosecutors who go out of their way to relate to. I've seen them cry over the results of things that have happened in different cases. I've also seen prosecutors who emotionally have to distance themselves from it because they can't handle it. They don't know what to do about it. They've done it for 2, 5, 10, 15 years, and they don't see a lot of success being made, and that is also part of the problem when you look around at our being able to come in to the courts, or by that I'm saying Narcotics Anonymous, when we go there as a presence, when we allow someone to go in with a signed meeting slip. And that, by the way, is an allowance, and I want to talk about it for a second, because there is an issue with the eighth tradition, which talks about we're not going to be affiliated with another organization. And that is, in my opinion, it's critical that we keep that. It's critical that we honor that, and it's critical that we recognize it. And there are meetings out there where they do not sign court cards. And they have taken that position because they don't want the affiliation. And if you explore that out, if court cards are signed and someone comes in and they put it in the basket, at that meeting, the person signing it knows that court card is going to go over and be given to a probation officer or a judge. And that raises other potential questions, like what if the judge looks at it and says, I don't believe these signatures. I've seen other people come in. That there are some judges who want to inquire, who don't understand the difference. They want to be able to bust anonymity. If necessary, they want to go out and say, well, who is your sponsor? How do I know you have a sponsor? And so it's a very tricky road that we walk by having people sign these slips that are being taken to court and presented to the court with the signature of a trusted servant from Narcotics Anonymous certifying that they were present at this meeting. I learned some things the last few days that have driven home to just me as an addict the importance of this difference. And we heard from some old-time speakers going back 50 years who were up here. Now, when Narcotics Anonymous was first started, there were some problems following the traditions. And as a result, from about 1953 to 1959, Narcotics Anonymous attendance went down. And by 1959, there was a period of 4 months where there wasn't a single Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And it was at that time it was attributed to what they called conflating with the other program, bringing in religion and potential dollar contributions to the program. And at that point it was Jimmy Kay who, as I understand it, put his foot down and said, we are going to go and enforce the traditions and live by them. I used five. I'm running out of time. So let me jump ahead a little bit, okay? Let me jump ahead to how Narcotics Anonymous actually interacts with the courts. Most people think of it as criminal. Well, think about it differently. Is there anyone in this room who knows someone who ran the risk of losing a child in dependency court? Is there anyone in this room who's heard about the concept of having someone's rights restricted by having a conservatorship put on them because they're disabled due to use of drugs? Has anyone known someone who had an insanity issue and they had to go back to court to try to establish that they were sane and restored to sanity? So Narcotics Anonymous, when you do this search that I talked about, you will come up with case after case after case, thousands of cases, where you find a reference to Narcotics Anonymous in the case law. And sometimes it makes a huge difference. And I want you to think about this. The courts don't talk about things that don't matter. When you read a court opinion and you look at it, they don't put in gratuitous comments. So when they talk about things that are considered and they use that Narcotics Anonymous phrase, it means they looked at it. And I want to highlight a couple of cases for you. One of them is a gentleman by the name of Eklund. He represented himself. He filed a writ of habeas corpus. He was in prison on a murder charge. And he was claiming that he should have been granted parole. And one of the things that they talked about was his behavior in prison. And one of the things that was talked about was the fact that while in prison, he did Narcotics Anonymous. Now, the parole board said, this guy's done it. He gets his parole date. He should be released. The governor looked at it, because he's got the right to look at all of them, and said, eh-eh. Ultimately, Eklund won. And he won at the Supreme Court. And one of the factors that was considered wasn't the only one by any stretch, but they talked about his participation in Narcotics Anonymous while he was in prison. When you talk about Romero cases, Jesus Romero was a fellow who got in trouble with some drugs, 0.16 grams, and they were striking him out for life. His case was the first one to go up. You've all heard about a Romero motion, right? And one of the things that they talk about in a Romero motion is the ability and the desire to stay clean. And that, I think, is the core that we need to always bear in mind. There's a case called Barrera. And Barrera was not granted strike relief. Barrera actually lost it on up. And the words that the court used were that he had not demonstrated the ability and the desire to stay crime-free and drug-free. So when you're looking at their minds, they're, in essence, looking at how we come to them, how do the clients come to them, and how much effort's been put in. The one thing that I tell a client when we go to court is I say, if you're asking the judge to do something for you, you need to be able to tell the judge, this is what I did. And another concept they talk about is criminality. They talk about not just drug use, but what they call the criminal mind. And if you know about Narcotics Anonymous, and judges know about this, they understand many things. One of the things they understand is that although the only requirement for membership is a desire to stay clean, if you stay clean, and if you stay around here, and if you work the steps, and if you get a sponsor, and if you hang with the right people, you tend not to do criminal behavior. So it's not just the absence of the drug use that the court's looking at. And I think that when we go to court as addicts and we're asking the court for some kind of relief, the court looks and says, what have you done? And I want to go back to what I first said. They don't know. Judges don't know. Society doesn't know. They want to put their hands on something where they can say, this person won't be as much of a risk to society, or they've gotten help. Narcotics Anonymous is a place to do that. I'm sorry I'm out of time, but thank you for letting me be here, and I hope at least some of it made sense. Thank you.